Hi, and welcome to Love Sober Podcast, the podcast for the sober and sober curious. I'm Kate Bailey. I'm a coach, an author, and I'm a Brit mum from West Sussex. Hi and welcome back, and today I've got a very special guest, Clover Stroud. And Clover is a writer and a journalist, a memoirist, and she's just written a fantastic new book called The Giant on the Skyline, on home, belonging and learning to let go. And in today's podcast, we dive into the topics of sobriety, of creativity, and what it means to live our lives as creative beings and human beings, sober, unfiltered. And our experience of life, essentially. So a big warm welcome to you, Clover.
Thank you very, very much. It's really lovely to be here. It's really lovely. I love talking about sobriety. I'm totally fascinated by it and the way it changes lives. And what's interesting is that there isn't always the opportunity to talk about it because it does make people uncomfortable, doesn't it? I do find, you know, people sometimes feel as though you're it can be a difficult thing to talk about because the discomfort it brings to others, but it doesn't make me feel uncomfortable at all. And I'm not, in talking about sobriety, I'm not trying to say other people must, but I think that, you know, if there's curiosity around it and the kind of revelation that comes with it, it's just changed my life so completely and in so many positive ways. I think conversations like this around it are fantastic. So it's lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, it's essentially a taboo topic, isn't it? Mm. And it has that kind of, like you said, that cure. What I love about taboos and that sort of slightly uncomfortable thing is I think it's brave. Mm. And I think that you are a brave writer. And I love your memoir and your writing because you go there. And so it feels entirely natural to me that you would come and talk. I don't know you well, but I feel like I know you a little bit through your writing.
My writing is very you know, I've just written my fourth memoir, The Giant on the Skyline, which is out next week, and all of this, you know, all four of my books are very confessional. They're very much, I take a topic like this one is about home and what it means to leave home and what is homesickness and what it is about home that we take with us, what we leave behind, you know, whether it's a place or an internal place or a landscape. So it really delves into that topic. But I've also written on grief. I've written on motherhood. I like to take a big aspect of life and then really kind of, you know, the more specific that I find that I'm about my own life and the more, the braver in a way that I can be about expressing the stuff that's happened in my life, which is, you know, I've had a lot of loss and a lot of trauma, then the more the people see their own experiences kind of reflected there. And I know from the messages I get on Instagram, where I post a lot, or on Substack, where I'm writing now as well, you know, people, that kind of writing helps people. And that's why these kind of conversations help people as well. And I love that sense that my personal experiences can be turned into a kind of something that can reach across time and space and place and being and reach into someone else's life, you know, and my words and in a way my suffering, I suppose. It's sort of like actually the pain, the loss, the things that I've been through and not, they have a real meaning. And when they're touching somebody else and helping somebody else, it's a really great feeling. I love it.
It's powerful, isn't it? And it's essentially, I see it's way of building community and feeling less alone. Essentially, as a writer, as podcasting, whatever the medium, that moment of connection with another human being is building.
Definitely, yeah. And I think, I mean, I started a podcast last year called Tiny Acts of Bravery, which is about bravery. And it's conversations around, you know, the things that we have to do or are forced into doing, and which can make us feel stronger and braver. And yeah, I definitely feel like that sense of connecting through words, whether it's written or spoken, to feel less alone is really integral to writing. And I, like, being a human being is a profoundly lonely experience, even whatever your circumstance. You know, I'm married. I've got a big family. I've got five children. I've got work I love. I've got good friends. And yet I can still feel really lonely. And I think, you know, whether it's in the workplace or amongst your family or friends, that there's a sense that actually the stuff that we have to walk through it in our heads alone. And I was really aware after my sister died in 2000, she died at the end of 2019. And my third book, The Red of My Blood, is about the year after her death. And I'm really close to my husband. I could talk to him about it, but he couldn't live through the loss of the sibling like I was having to. And it really brought home to me how lonely life could be. And I think writing communication like this is a real, really positive, really strong way of feeling less alone, basically.
And I think as you were saying that, my mind was going to those sort of intensely human experiences that, like you said before, are kind of universal and common, loving and losing. And I have to just say, I'm really sorry for the loss of your sister. And, I just wanted to acknowledge that. And these feelings. And then this, my mind is going how the alcohol intersects with that and drinking to kind of, how we use alcohol. I know for me, a habitual thing that crept up over many years and a sort of socially normative way of kind of dealing with all the stuff.
Yeah, no, I find it really fascinating because when I look back on, so I'm 49 and I gave up drinking, it'll be 3 years ago this August. So it's, and I find it really fascinating when I look back at my 20s and 30s and the stuff that I was getting through and I was drinking at the same time. And now I think, oh my God, the drinking from a short-term point of view, yes, there is relief in whatever, alcohol you like to drink. When I was younger, it was Bennett, it's that young thing of sort of drinking anything basically. But as I got older, it was sort of like, vodka or wine. But actually it just makes the experience of life so, so much harder. And so my drinking journey was like, I was young in the 90s. So I was part of the rave generation. I went to university in the 90s. It was really wild and really incredible. I'd had a terribly traumatic, I'd had a very happy childhood. And then a really, really traumatic thing happened when I was 16, which is my mum had a horrific accident, which left her very profoundly brain damaged and alive, but not able to walk or talk or look after herself. And that sent me and my sister Nell out in a quite, we sort of reacted to that by going out into the world and going hard at life. And it was when, the rave scene was just starting. We partied really hard. We took loads of drugs. We drank a lot. And alcohol and drugs were like a way of escaping the reality of our mum. I was 16, Nell was 18. We were young women. We were adolescents, basically. Mum with profound brain damage. And alcohol seemed like this hedonistic, beautiful escape, a way of, getting away from everything. And everybody at that time, absolutely, the idea of being sober at that time, nobody was sober. It wasn't a cultural movement in any way.
It really wasn't.
And so, to get completely drunk, to drink until you had blackout, was a sort of point of pride in a way. And I carried on drinking like that. And then I had my first two children in my 20s, who are 23 and 20 now. And then I brought them up. I was a single mum, and I still carried on drinking. And I carried on drinking all the way through. And then I met my second husband, who I'm happily married to now, and had another three kids. And I used alcohol as a prop, as an escape. And as I got into my 30s, because I had young children, it wasn't going out on all night benders, but it was, drinking, the kind of culture of drinking as a relief from, as a relief to the demands of motherhood. That thing of, it became particularly kind of sort of horrible, really, like wine o'clock, and that whole idea that you kind of bury the sort of the end of the day shouting in a bottle of wine. And I realized that I was drinking quite a bit in my early 40s. And I don't, it's really interesting, the question of like, well, was I an alcoholic? And so I was drinking, I was in my early, I drank in a kind of normal, a heavy but not particularly abnormal way, as it were. I wasn't drinking in the daytime. I wasn't drinking. I'd get drunk at the weekends or drink a bit more at the weekends, parties. I'd have a couple of nights in the week when I was drinking a bit. And then my sister got very, very ill in 2015, and she gave up drinking. She got cancer. She gave up drinking as part of her treatment. And it was very wonderful watching her. Really, me and her talked about it a lot. We talked about it a lot, and she was an artist. She was a really incredible woman called Nell Gifford, and she was always producing a lot of art. But in those, it was actually turned out to be the last 4 years of her life. She died in 2019. Her creativity just absolutely was like supercharged, and she said it was partly because of her sobriety. And watching that happen was really amazing. And I had a few periods where I stopped during that time. And I actually wrote about that a bit in my second book, which is called My Wild and Sleepless Nights, which is about motherhood. And I stopped in order to support my adolescent son, who was going through his A levels and was in tons of trouble at school. And, so I had a kind of, me and Nell used to talk about sometimes you need to just take a bit of a pull. And even if you don't completely give up, just a period of abstinence. But after she died, I used alcohol as a way of, as a way of numbing the pain, definitely in the first few months after she died. And if I'm completely honest, it did help. It did, the absolutely excruciating agony of dealing with the reality of her death, but then waking up to the reality of her death in the morning with a hangover is a terrible thing. So I suddenly decided, a snap decision actually, in the summer of 21, I guess it was. I was on holiday in France. Nell had been dead for a year. I was with my younger kids. I had three small kids, and I just felt so out of control. I felt as though I was in France, and my son was like walking around. My little son, my little like he was a little tiny thing at the time. He just wouldn't put any clothes on, and I just remember walking through this like very sort of neat little French village with all these children totally out of control, and I thought, I'm hungover. I look awful. I'm like my wardrobe is out of control. My children are out of control. My drinking is out of control. And then we were on a drive somewhere, coming back from the beach, and our car broke down. And I thought, okay, I'm going to use this. It was beside a kebab van. I remember it so clearly because
I love the
my
fact that there was a kebab. That's so cute.
it's totally linked to this kebab. I thought, right, I'm going to use this experience of a really quite unpleasant family holiday where I didn't enjoy it, and then breaking down to be the moment that's going to change my life in a positive way. And I decided then to stop drinking as I was sitting by this kebab shop. And I've posted about it on my Instagram. I've even got a photograph of it, actually. I could send you a photograph of it, I think. But I haven't drunk since then, and I've just found it absolutely, I found it an absolute revelation. And when I look back at struggling through my 20s with two young kids and dealing with the trauma of my mum's accident. She was alive for 22 years, very profoundly brain damaged, dealing with divorce. All of that was done through a web of alcohol. And I sometimes wonder, what would it have been like without any alcohol? I'm also really curious about whether, like, the revelation that comes with sobriety and the gift that it appears to be and the absolute superpower that you feel it charges you with, does it? If you've never drunk, do you always feel like that? Or is it in contrast to how you felt before? So
That's such a good question.
that's how I got sober. That's how, and I did it without, I didn't go to AA. I just decided to stop. I did talk to some really good friends. I leaned on the support of some really, really good friends. And to start with, things like Friday nights were really painful, or being around people who were drinking and just like, oh, that intense desire for a drink. And now I don't really, I mean, very occasionally I think, oh, I'd very like maybe once a year, I think, oh, I'd like a drink, but I just don't. Now I just think, why would I want to do that to myself? Like, how on earth? So we moved from England to America last year for my husband's work. And that was a big thing, packing up my house, organizing my two elder kids who stayed at home in England, taking three younger kids. It's a massive thing to relocate to a new country. And I was finishing my book. I was launching my podcasts, Tiny Acts of Bravery. I just don't think I could have done that if I'd been like
No.
drinking at the same time. I don't think I could have done that. And I've really found that that I stopped in my mid 40s. It was a really, really good moment to stop for me, definitely.
I did too, actually. It's that midlife axis for me is like that pivot point is, we've got perimenopause hitting in, we've got the kids, we've got all of the stuff, we've got the wounds that the accumulated kind of savagery of whatever is going on. And I see so many Pete, I think so many people are going to relate to what you're talking about. Also, in terms of that, it doesn't necessarily look like what we were told alcohol issues looked like. We talk about grey area drinking and it's a massive spectrum. And our culture, it normalizes the grey area. So it can be very confusing and we're using it for all manner of things. And what I find interesting, I just want to dive into something because you were talking about, grief and alcohol. And I do feel like my personal reflection on this is that I feel like, I don't know if this is true or not, I sort of have this kind of, image of kind of how we used to be in terms of rituals, rites of passage, transition periods where we could hold and ritualize particularly savage life events and losses, and we don't have that, and we do need something to help with the pain. We do, and so I could totally understand why that would come in at that point, and then obviously it's you're left with that, but.
That's a really, and I hadn't really thought of that, and it's a really, really interesting, smart observation that we don't have the kind of, I mean, I don't want to idealize the past because I think it's very easy to look back and think, oh, it was all, more innocent and this, but that,
Yeah,
like,
it's like a
there was
Constable painting in my head. It's like the hay wain and things like that. Anyway.
no, and the reality of disease, I mean, just the reality of it must have been so different. But community spaces, community support, I mean, I've become very aware moving to a new country where I have no community at all. I'm slowly weaving it back together, how incredibly powerful community is. Even if you don't, it doesn't need to, I think when we say community, we think of somebody who's volunteering and helping out and doing part of this and part of that. Actually, community is just the people can, I mean, it's brilliant if you do that, obviously, but not all of us can, not all of us have the characters for that, or the wherewithal, or the time. And I don't do a whole lot of that, I have to admit, in my old life, but in when I lived in England. But I did have a very strong community of people that I saw on a daily basis. I lived in a small rural community that might have been going into the village shop, going seeing people on the road, friends that I bumped into, and losing that suddenly really reminded me of how strong community is. And I think that, yeah, that space of being together and kind of marking something, and the rituals around grieving have vanished totally. And actually, Nell and me went through grief for our mum. She died in 2013, and it was interesting because we grew up being taken to church, which we like bitterly resented as children. But after mum died, we both said, "Oh, this is why you go to church when you're a child, so that when somebody dies, we personally, and I know not all people would find this, but we personally found great solace in the solemnity of going into a church and the candles and the music and the kind of ritualized prayers and hymns and so on." And that was really, really, really helpful. And but yeah, we have kind of lost that. And in a way, gathering together around a bottle of wine is like a ritual, isn't it? And it's strange when you lose that ritual as well, because you do have to find something else to replace it
Yeah,
with, in a way.
I would say keep the ritual, change the ingredients, because for the need for our social rituals is so fundamental because we're so pro-social, aren't we?
Yeah, but and I find it interesting as well that when you give up drinking, I went to someone's house the other day and I said, I try not to make a big thing of, oh no, I don't drink. I'll say just, oh no, I'll just have, I don't. And sometimes in the past, I've actually taken a drink in order to make some, not and held it, not drunk it, but to make some, so somebody feel less awkward, less embarrassed. But I feel more, it's weird though that we have to feel as though we have to make the alcohol, we have to make the life around the alcohol comfortable in a way, rather than to say, no, I don't drink. Now I just say, no, I don't drink. It's fine. But when it was at somebody's house not so long ago, and they were having like a gin and tonic, lovely big glass, ice, lemon, so on. And I said, no, I'm okay. I won't have a drink. And I was given like a sort of lukewarm glass of water.
You are punished.
And in a way, I think I create a bit of a ritual around tea. I drink a lot of tea, and having nice tea and things like that is like a real, it's a real treat actually. I really love it. But yeah, where we find those other rituals is really important. And I do quite a lot of kind of candle lighting and creating. Me and the kids always do this thing in the autumn of creating a death table, which I really enjoy doing, and I've posted about on my Instagram. And I first did with my sister actually one Halloween. She was very theatrical, very incredible artist, and she sort of laid the table out. And she lived in the country, so did I. And so she just found some like stones, leaves, sticks, and made the table look beautiful to kind of ritualize Halloween. And we did that a few years before she died. And now me and the kids always do it and create this table that we have the kitchen table covered in anything that we can find. Once we went to a charity shop and bought a load of little ceramic foxes and little sort of tubs of animals, badgers and stuff. But that kind of stuff is really, yeah, it's really helpful kind of stuff to kind of hang your feelings on, to in order to feel what you're going through more deeply. Because it's weird, because you think that alcohol, I mean, what it actually does to your feelings is really interesting, isn't it? Because it kind of, that first glass of wine, that first drink, that first half glass of wine does. There is joy in that. It is delicious. It is kind of a nice glass, and the color of the alcohol, and and there is a kind of beauty in that, and the way it makes you feel to start with. But then it was interesting actually. The other day I did accident, and I don't count this as drinking. So I was with some friends, and they ordered a cocktail, and I ordered a mocktail, and they didn't. They obviously got the order wrong, because I was bought a rum cocktail, and I drank some of it. And I was with these friends, and I thought we were having some food, and I thought it was in a beautiful setting and so on. And I feel really weird and really disconnected and really quite low. What's wrong with me? Why am I feeling so low? Because this is a really, we were swimming. It was a lovely place. And then I had another like drink of this, and then I suddenly was like, I said to my friend, like, taste this. Has this got alcohol in it? And I had drunk, they bought me an alcoholic drink. And so I don't count that, although I'm being
No,
completely
it's not intentional, is
it
it?
wasn't
So,
intended. And I
no.
immediately gave it to them, and like I was like, I do not want any more of that. I found it so fascinating that my actual emotional reaction to two mouthfuls of alcohol was like, I feel really bad. I feel
But it's a nervous system depressant.
I feel low, I feel disconnected, I don't want to be here. And that was a real, I found that so, I almost felt toxic afterwards, like, get this stuff out of my system. I want to be, because until then I'd been saying to them, oh, isn't this beautiful? And look at the light on the trees. And it's, isn't this lovely to be together? And then suddenly I felt bad. And alcohol, it does dull your sense, dulls you, dulls your senses, and it dulls the joy of life. And I think that we get so confused with the idea that alcohol is a treat, and it's like makes things fun, and it makes things bubbly and fizzy and outrageous, and we can dance. It's been a revelation to me that after I love dance, dancing totally sober. I went to a party last weekend and I danced for ages, and that was just such fun. It's just such a laugh being able to dance and feel yourself completely, and that feeling of all of the experiences that I'm going through. And yet, yes, you have to feel the harder experiences. There's nothing that takes the edge off the hard experience. There's no wine to take
Sort
the
of
edge.
unfiltered, isn't it? It's the unfiltered life.
But the payoff that you get in terms of the beauty of your life is really, really extraordinary. And I think it takes a while to receive that, doesn't it? It
It
takes,
does.
for me, it took It's actually ever increasing. With each month that I'm sober, I feel it more. But I don't think I felt it necessarily for the first. It felt like a loss initially. It was a relief not to ever have to wake up and think, "Am I hungover? How hungover am I?" But that does feel like a loss in it for quite a while, a few months, I
I
think.
found I wrote a post about that this morning. I wrote my Substack this morning, and it was about that. The end of it was about this. I've just been watching Daisy Jones and the Six. I don't know if you've
Okay.
seen that, right? And I've been loving that because I rock and roll in the past, blah, blah, blah. But it's reminding me, because as I'm going through the sort of menopause, and I've got a house full of teenagers, it's like my teenager is so raw at the moment. My inner teenager is cycling around, and I'm like, I can't out rock and roll any of you. Like, seriously, seriously. Like, shall we go point by point, people? Anyway, I'm just so that they're annoying me basically, and so what was I going to say? Oh, but I was kind of bringing it back to the sober message and how that we do get those wild, we find those nooks and crannies and wildnesses inside and the young bits and all of it. But it doesn't feel like that at the beginning. We've got to build that foundation, like repetition day by day. And you do get to stand on top of that foundation. But like you're saying, it's essentially it's that muscle power of habit change.
See, I think
Scientifically.
it's interesting when people do something like Sober January, and a good friend was doing that, and he said, "Oh, I've been sober for 3 weeks. I don't really feel any different at all. I'm going to start drinking again because I don't really feel any
It's not
different." And
long enough, is it?
well, it's barely even started, it's
No.
very, 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 just like step taking the first step. So what I wrote about it on my Substack as well. I said, what it's like, it's like you've lived in this house your whole life. There's a door at the back of the house, which is a bit, and there's a long corridor, and that you've never opened the door of that corridor. And then you sort of discover this door, and then you stop drinking, and then you walk down that corridor, and that corridor is quite dark and scary, and you can't see where you're going. And then you come out into the light, and that's the first kind of few weeks, months even. And then you come out into the light, and then you discover within this house that you've been living in all your life, a load of new rooms and a view out to a landscape that you've never seen. And in a way, that's like your new sober life, is you're living in the same body, you've got the same life, but you have got all these new spaces to go into. And that's where emotionally, I feel a lot calmer. I think people think that when you stop drinking, you must like suddenly that, you no longer get depressed, you no longer get anxious. Actually, that's not the case at all. You still definitely feel all those things really deeply, and you have to work through them. But you also, I feel like much calmer with my children. I feel much calmer within my marriage. So if we have an argument, which obviously we do, a normal married couple, we have loads of arguments. I'm much better at just saying, not sort of taking offense, not having hurt feelings, not having all the sort of drunk or hungover or alcoholic feelings of everything being over accentuated for no reason other than alcohol is brought into that equation. I'm much more kind of reasonable about things. We still have like massive, massive shouting type of arguments, but they calm down much, much quickly. And I'm calmer with the kids. I don't get angry with the kids so much, and that's it's much it just makes life so much easier. And now I think, I just thought the thought of waking up with a hangover, the thought of having to struggle through the day with a hangover, and the thought of being kind of deprived of the clarity and joy. And in midlife, I personally found my early 40s, I was very, very stressed. I guess that was probably my perimenopause. I mean, I'm still having, I don't think I've gone through my menopause yet, but I'm sure that I'm having some of the symptoms and stuff like that. And I felt very stressed out in my early 40s. There was a lot of stuff. My sister was ill. I had very young kids, lots of very difficult stuff going on. But right now at 49, I feel, and sober for 3 years, I feel like I'm stronger than I've ever been. I feel like my creativity, is really, really pumped up. I'm really delighted by the state of my skin from a just a vanity point of view. I'm really
The
delighted by
skin is great.
my
The skin
skin.
is a really good, really happy byproduct
It's
of
amazing.
sobriety.
It's amazing, isn't it? I know, and people say to me, like, "Oh, you're doing HRT or
The
something," and
cheery
I'm not
glow.
at all. I'm just sober, basically. But the thing that I found most interesting is for my creativity. So this didn't happen straight away. And I wrote my last book, The Red of My Blood, I wrote in the year after my sister's death during lockdown when I was still drinking. And then I stopped drinking. And then I wrote my new book, The Giant on the Skyline. And I found that the way that I could... So my writing is all about the clear and very honest and powerful expression of emotion. And I found that my ability to describe emotion and put myself back inside an emotion and feel my life and then put that onto the page was really strong. And I also then found that it almost became, this was surprising. My creativity felt so sort of supercharged. And I was working hard. It wasn't just like sitting around waiting for creativity to arrive. I was creating
the circumstances. Crafting it.
And I found that in the writing of this book, which is about home, my relationship between myself and the place that I was writing about became almost fluid, almost trippy. I live in a very beautiful, well, when I was living in England, I lived in a very beautiful part of the world in very green hills, South Oxfordshire. It's really lovely. And I felt as though me and the landscape sort of, and this was thinking deeply about it and writing about it every day, I almost felt myself flowing into the landscape and the landscape flowing into me. And that was a really, really, kind of beautiful, powerful experience. And I don't think that would have happened if I had been drinking, because I would have had that block that is still there. That, you know, I really see alcohol as like a block between you and yourself, you and your people who you love, you and the world. It is a kind of... Now I almost see it like as a wall of bottles of red wine. It is something that stops you pushing into that place of deeper connection, deeper creativity, deeper understanding. And I wish that, you know, I'd like... It's funny because I was with a friend not so long ago and she said she was having a drink. She said, oh, no, I'm not going to have a drink because it's not really fair on you if I drink. And I thought... No, it's not. I didn't say this. I thought, honestly, it's not really fair on you if you drink. It's for me,
I love
really,
that.
Really, it's really, really easy. And it's not, you know, I wouldn't dream of like putting alcohol in my system and removing this kind of extraordinary connection to the world that I sometimes feel. It's not all there, you know, it's not all there all the time. I'm a normal human being, but the kind of access to that clarity of vision, of feeling is really, really, really exciting. It's a really exciting thing.
No, what you've just said, I love what you said, and I really relate to it, because about a year ago, I live in West Sussex and I'm near the South Downs National Park. We've got woods near us. And about a year ago, I accidentally inherited a dog, a big dog that needed walking every day. Like, I was like, really, have I not got enough to do? But I was like, okay, I must have known that I needed a dog. And so this dog has taken me out to my woods every single day. And every single day, so I only go to this particular woods because he's only safe there near the roads. And what it's done every day, I didn't realize that this was becoming creative, sort of almost a therapeutic practice to metabolize my life. But I've become intimate with that wood. I've seen things in that wood day to day to day that I would have missed when I was only going once every 3 weeks. And I have to go there. I have to go there literally to metabolize my life, listen to my headphones. I'm right when I come back. And so what you said about this kind of, when you feel like the landscape flowing in and out of you, I understand that. I really do. And I too don't think I would experience that if I was not sober, because like you said, you numb out all the sensitivity and the lightness and the almost the end of the tentacles. You kind of nuke them when you drink.
Yeah. I think I agree. It's like when Nell was sober in the last few years of her life, she said it's like there's been spider's webs in front of your eyes, neck, slowly clearing and clearing and clearing and clearing. And it's greater and greater clarity, isn't it? And I remember walking across the field at home in England, and we had three dogs in England, and my dogs were running around. It just reminded me of they were running through the field, and I thought, their dog, the dogs look so beautiful running through the field, and the way the grass is moving, and the movement on the light, and the joy that the dogs are communicating to me. And I remember thinking, if I'd still been drinking, it was like 6 o'clock, I'd have been thinking, oh, I want to drink now. You know, I'm going to go back to the house. I want to drink. And
you'd have left that moment.
Yeah, I would have left that moment.
Yeah.
And it kind of enables you. And I find myself saying to my kids quite a lot, well, last night, me and Pete, my husband, were like doing a load. We were working on something late together. And then I went to let the dog out, actually. And I said to him, come outside, Pete. It's just so beautiful out here. And, you know, it was just like it was just the night and the sounds of the night were just beautiful. And I feel as though I just feel things and inhabit the world in a deeper way. And I love that.
That's so beautiful. I think it's so lovely for people listening in as well. Like, you know, we've gone the sort of circuitous route talking about sobriety and that kind of how it impacts on creativity. And obviously you're a seasoned author, you're, you know, a hugely successful writer. And for people listening in, I feel like we all create. So like if you're listening in and thinking, oh, but I'm not this or I'm not that, you'll be so surprised possibly at what might come out when you're sober, because we're, as kids, we create constantly, don't we?
No, definitely. And I don't think it means, like, for me, writing has been really important, but I'm no, you know, visual drawing artist. I literally can't. My children, if they want a laugh, they ask me to draw stick man because it all looks just so ridiculous. I cannot figuratively draw. But one afternoon, you know, last year, I started, just picked up some paints because the kids were mucking around, and I started painting these color block pictures. And I found I love doing it. I really, really, really enjoy doing it. And there's that thing of in the evenings of rather than sitting around with a glass in your hand, you have to do something. I'd like to get more into kind of knitting. I'd love to learn how to knit, how to crochet and stuff like that. But it doesn't, you know, whether it's, you don't have to be a good artist or a great artist or an accomplished artist to just get joy from stuff like that when you're
playing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Permission to play, really.
Yeah.
And I think it's something really nice about doing something that is not your preferred medium or the medium that you're expert at. So choose something that you're like, I'm not saying I'm a visual artist at all, but I joined this amazing sober artist community from Tammy Salas, who she's wicked. And we do lots of different arts. It might be photography one week, or it might be like, yeah, like paint. Like, I am so shit at painting, but I like it so much.
Well, so, I can see your painting on the love it. I can see it on your screen. It looks lovely.
Hello, yeah, you're very, very kind. But there is something to be said for going where you're shit. I think we get the bravery and the freedom and the bandwidth to do that as well when we're sober, quite frankly, because I'm like, man, I don't drink, I do my life every day. Like, I'm sure that I can try and crochet and be shit at it and cope with that feeling.
It's also the other day I was thinking about, you know, the amount of money I've saved as well. Yeah, I mean, I haven't saved it, I wish I'd just sort of put away, you know, whatever the price is for a couple of bottles of wine a week or whatever, because it would be a lot of money. That's kind of the liberation of time, the liberation of money, the liberation of anxiety is all just so kind of, it's just like there's so much payoffs for it. But it's interesting how... still the discomfort. It's quite hard to stop drinking because of the social pressure, isn't it? That, I mean, it's hard because it's addictive and it can be hard to lose that ritual and habit. But it's hard as well because of the expectation of drinking and the feeling of, and I definitely had this more to start with, of friends going, you know, I was a very hedonistic person. I think they thought, oh, you know, she stopped drinking. She's really boring. And that, it's just actually for me now, the boring bit is, like, it's not boring. It's actually like, It's like tripping sometimes. That's how extreme and
It's
exciting
like
it.
really, really people are like, you don't get this. Like it really is not boring. And I feel like what you said though is really interesting, and it almost brings us back to the beginning of the podcast about connection, because I think you're totally right. I think though, I work with people coaching, and the biggest fear for most people is the social thing, because we are social and we want to belong and we want to connect and we need to, hardwired to. And so we are sold this message. You literally, you need me to connect. Your clinking of the glasses, you need me to be happy, you need me to connect. And you flip that. The sinister thing is it alcohol marketing says you cannot connect without me. You cannot have fun without me. So no wonder people are terrified and struggle with that. Because of course we want to still be fun and happy and connected and belong. So much unpicking. So I think you're so right. And I think that what is so wonderful about what you're saying and what your message is, Clover, is that you're not going, oh no, it's not hard. You're like, actually, it is tough. You feel everything, but the payoffs are like, it's really worth it. Everyone keep going, because it's actually, you get so much back.
Really worth it, and it gets better and better. You know, the first 3 months is really hard, and but it will get better. And also the cumulative effects of it, what we were saying, you know, that the cobwebs clearing gets stronger and stronger. And if you've done 2 weeks not drinking, you think, oh, I still feel the same. Just, you know that you're just at the beginning, and like push on through, keep going. And also the desire for drinks, it's a bit like when you give up smoking, you know. And I was a heavy smoker and could smoke 20 cigarettes a day, which, and I was actually even smoking like about 4 years ago. I remember I went back to smoking, and now I think, oh my God. But you know, when you stop smoking, that thing of really having the addiction of that is really, really intense. But if you just resist it, it's almost by like being given like a pinprick or somebody pinching you really hard, and then it goes away, you know. And it's the same with drinking. And I find that in the beginning bit, in that sort of crunch time, you know, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, when the people are drinking, by 9 o'clock, actually, if I hadn't had a drink, I didn't really want to like crack into a drink at that point, and just kind of hold on tight and push on through and do anything. Go and, you know, classic one is go and have a bath, but do anything to just distract yourself from that very short-term relief. Very, very short-term relief. And you will find, you know, those rooms that I talked about, those rooms within your head, within your soul, within your consciousness, which are really, really are there waiting for you. And yeah, whether you're, you know, whether you think of yourself as a creative person or not, that the payoffs are, and I do believe we're all, you know, whether it's baking a cake or writing a book or learning how to dance or spending more time outside walking, you know, they'll the gifts that you're given will be massive and unending, as far as I can see. I mean, I'm very interested how, you know, the next, as I go into further into midlife, kind of what the next bit holds, I suppose. And I'm very excited about what I can do and what I can write, and my stronger connections with my kids and my husband. That's, you know, I'm really happy about that. And I think if I was drinking, I would be facing this next bit of life with a great deal more anxiety and trepidation, and the horror of like a hangover, even a small hangover. I'm just really, really relieved that I've given myself the gift of not having to deal with that.
Yeah, amen to that. Amen to that. And I think, like you said, the midlife, I feel like the midlife is a really great time. But it's almost like how I feel about neurodivergence. It's slightly tangential, but you know, the great strengths and the challenges. So if you've got amazing kind of potential, but you have to support the challenges. And I feel like that a bit like midlife with all the hormones and this, we can't, like men can just kind of pretend they're not having the midlife, and women can't because we menopause. And in that moment, we get to decide a different choice. I think we really do. It's like the devil at the crossroads. It's like, right, you can not really ignore this. And so to for me, stopping drinking gave me back hope because I was like, I'm on a groundhog day. I know what this can look like. I have no idea what sober can look like. And all the waning gifts of youth, of the energy and the kind of, you know, the physical strength, it's like I'm giving my best chance at looking after those. And now I get to what's the next bit going to look like? Well, how am I going to write the next bit, you know? Which is so super interesting, especially when you're saying like you get this gift of kind of experiencing the world really authentically, viscerally. That's rich, right? That's rich. Why would we not?
No, definitely. Why would you not? I mean, I absolutely agree with that, 100%.
This has just been such an amazing, amazing chat to have with you. Thank you so much, Clover. Put everything in the show notes. And as we said, Clover's, I'm going to turn this around quickly. So your book will be available for pre-order from next week, I believe.
It's available for pre-order now.
Now.
It comes out on the 8th of May. So anybody listening to this, if you... Yeah, I mean, I really feel like my writing helps people. I really communicate emotion, and people find themselves in my writing. So, yeah, I would love it if anybody wanted to order the book, The Giant on the Skyline, and also, you know, come and find me on Instagram or Substack. I love talking. I write for a conversation. You know, I write to communicate with people, and I love to kind of, you know, chat with people about the ideas, about writing, about creativity, about sobriety, motherhood, grief, all those kind of things. I really like talking about that stuff, and sobriety is a big part of it, certainly. So come and find me on one of those platforms, and
And I'll link all of those below for sure. So I will be putting this out. You'll be hopefully tuning into this on the weekend of the 4th of May. So go find Clover's book, find her on Substack, find her on Instagram. Everything is below. And Clover, we always finish with just the question, the cute question. What is, and you kind of answered it, but what is your reason to love sober today? Love being sober today.
It's a superpower. It's, for me, it's absolutely everything. It's given me I didn't think of myself as someone who was in the depths of addiction, but it has, removing the way that I drank out of my life, just taking it away, taking that question of drinking away, is so liberating, and it is such a gift. And it's, for the short term pain of stopping, the long term gain is absolutely massive. So if you're considering it, I would say go for it. You will. There is like an incredible world waiting. Those rooms in your head, your heart, and your soul are waiting for you. Just step into them.
I love that. I love that. I love the rooms in the head. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you very, very much indeed. It's been really, really great.